Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Pat Barron, standing in for regular host and founder of Radio Free Market, Michael McKay. And normally at this point you would say that Michael is taking the day off or the weekend off or the week off, but I can assure you that Michael never takes any time off. He's always working for freedom, and that is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we really have an exciting show for you today. I think you're going to enjoy it. I have on the line one of my students at the University of Iowa, Cole Chaney. So, Cole, do you want to say hello?
Hello, everybody. I'm a recently graduated economics major, and I actually met Pat in sort of the Austrian economic movement through a course that he taught called Intro to Austrian Economics. We followed up. I was so interested in the course, and Pat did such a good job that I ultimately took a class on Mises' Human Action. And that's sort of where I all got started on this interest.
Yes, and today what Cole and I are going to do is we're just going to hold a conversation and talk to you today about studying the book Human Action. Now, Cole, do you know the background of Human Action? If not, I'll give the listeners a short background, but do you know the background of Human Action?
I think I'm going to look like I don't know a lot here, but my basic understanding of Human Action is that it was accumulating all of his economic knowledge into a single body of work, but I actually don't know the formal background of why it got written.
Well, it was written in 1949. I think that may have actually been the date it was published. But actually, when you say it was written in 49, it was actually, as you say, it was an accumulation of Ludwig von Mises' work for, probably a good 50 years. And he had originally written a prelude, or sort of, I would say, a preliminary volume of this that in German, that had a German name to it that I can't pronounce. But it was published in 1940 when he was still in Geneva. And, of course, in 1940, it was very poor timing. The world was at war, and people were not buying economics books. So his volume at that point was ignored. He eventually came to America. Actually, he escaped to America with his wife. Von Mises was a champion of freedom and an arch enemy of the Nazis. And he was Austrian, which was then part of the Nazi Empire. And the Nazis actually trashed his apartment in Vienna and burned his extensive library. So when he came to America, he started touching up, I guess you would say, the book that he had written in German. And it became this magnum opus, his great work called Human Action. And Human Action is really considered one of the greatest economics books of all time by those of us who are Austrian economists, and it's recognized as a great book by those who are not Austrian economists. So what Cole and I are going to do is just discuss this book. So we have just about a minute left in this first segment. This is a short first segment, but Cole, I wonder if you would mind just telling the listeners how you found the book to read. Was it easy to read? What help did you get? What was sort of your general impression?
So the book is really, while it is an economics book, it is a philosophy book as well, and that was where I did struggle in that I didn't understand sort of the basis of philosophy, where you start at the very basic foundations. You establish something that's irrefutable and then build from that point, because otherwise the entire argument can fall like a house of cards. Once I sort of realized this basis, the book became actually really easy to read. His language is pretty simple. It's amazing for a guy that was not a native English speaker. I'm sure he got help and translator. It was overall an incredibly easy book to read, and there's actually a guide sort of for the less economically and philosophically versed people to understand what he was trying to get at for some of his major points.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to cut away for a short commercial break right here, but when we come back, we will pick up where Cole left off about what was Ludwig von Mises' philosophical basis that is really the very foundation for his Austrian economics. So please stay with us. We'll be right back on Radio Free Market. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Pat Barron, your guest host this week on Radio Free Market. And I have as my guest my student from the University of Iowa, Cole Chaney. And when we broke away for the first commercial break, Cole was discussing the great book Human Action and how Ludwig von Mises starts with some philosophy. So without getting real detailed into this, Cole, I wonder if you would speak to that issue and why von Mises' philosophy, his epistemology, as we call it, how you know what you know, why that's so important for economics.
Well, see, the fundamental basis of Mises' philosophy is that man acts, which it sounds like such a simple, rudimentary phrase, but it's fairly important. And, you know, once you set this irrefutable phrase, you can really build a whole philosophy out of it. So man acts. Trying to even refute the statement by saying, well, man doesn't act. Well, actually, I acted by saying man doesn't act. So it becomes a false circular logic. So you have to accept it on the face value. And then with that, you can start to build a whole framework out of this economically. So, you know, because man acts, well, how does he choose when to act? He can't act 19 different actions at once. In fact, he can only do one thing. He can choose to buy a cup of coffee, or he could choose to go to work to earn money for that cup of coffee. So because of that, you realize that man valuates things. He evaluates different things and then chooses an option. And then from this, you can really start to build, you know, a fundamental framework. This can't tell you exactly what man will do based on a certain interest rate, and it can't tell you what a man will do with a home purchasing decision, but it really can start to set a fundamental basis for how economically a person will act.
Yeah, I think there's a great book by Austrian economist Hans Hermann Hoppe, and this book, I think I have the name of it here someplace, and I'll look for it as I'm chatting. But in this book, Hoppe, in just a few pages, leads us through, well, what logically can we deduce from the fact that man does act? Well, we can say that he acts to accomplish a purpose. He wants to do something. And, excuse me, I've got a big enough tickle cough today. And he attempts to accomplish something. He has a purpose. Well, how does he decide what that purpose is? And Hoppe says, well, he arranges things logically in his mind by preferences. So man adopts his preferences. He tries to accomplish something. And he tries to accomplish this by acting. Well, what is he trying to do? Well, he's trying to increase his satisfaction. We can just use that as a phrase. Increase his satisfaction. He wants to go from a state of being less satisfied to a state of being more satisfied. And he does this by use of reason, saying, according to my reason, this is what I want to accomplish. And I believe that this action that I am taking up will accomplish that.
Yeah, and some people know it as utility. I mean, happiness is sort of this ambiguous phrase, and it's something that's hard to quantify, but it really is a personal satisfaction, utility. I mean, I'm trying to think of a better way to express it, Pat, but that is just about all we can do.
Yeah, I think that's enough for, we don't want to scare people off from reading this book, but I believe that if you read the book, you will get a greater appreciation for why this is important for understanding economic policy and why government interference, for example, is almost always detrimental to man, because you really, man is trying to accomplish something himself, and if government interferes with that, well, then it's not allowing him to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Now, that doesn't mean that a man can go out and harm anyone. That's one of the tenets of the morality of Austrian economics, is you can attempt to work cooperatively with other people, but you cannot say, well, Cole and I are going to act cooperatively to go harm someone else and rob them. Well, we can't do that. What we can do is act cooperatively.
Yep.
To go sell someone something that he may desire. So that's really a very important point.
And I want to talk about, too, sort of something cool you mentioned that's fundamental to Austrian economics, is that it's individual. The individual acts, I think this is sort of where Mises really diverges from the Marxist view of these collective social classes acting. You know, any action that happens as a whole or as a group is really because it's a group of individuals that have similar-minded ideas or preferences, rather than a whole group of people having this single mind think. It's actually every single person in that group individually makes that decision. And that's sort of, that is where they really diverge, and I think where Austrian economics shows that it's very hard to say that there's a upper class taking advantage of a lower class or a working class taking advantage of a non-working class. All those sort of distinctions go by the wayside. It's a huge, I'd say, breakthrough of the book.
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, this gets back to the very heart of the American experience, which is based upon individual liberty, and that American government was established by our founding fathers to secure our individual liberty. It isn't founded to secure the liberty only of certain people, but to secure the individual liberty of everyone in society. And that really is very important because, as you say, there's a Marxist idea that we are all driven by class consciousness. And Mises, very early in the book, destroys that argument very effectively by saying that, well, Marx just claims that, but he gives no evidence for it. In fact, there is no evidence for that people act out of class consciousness. They act out of individual preferences. In fact, if you need examples, you can say, well, why do some people who are of the same class vote for different political candidates?
Yep.
Well, they have a different preference, and the preferences can be very complex.
Or what about Marx himself, who was part of the upper middle class and sort of recognized with the lower class movement? I mean, even himself is sort of a walking contradiction of this mindset.
Right. Well, let's move on, Cole, to I think one of the most important aspects that we Austrians keep trying to point out, and that is that the free market promotes peace, freedom, and prosperity. And especially underlining all of this is peace. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what von Mises says is usually, not always, but is usually what precipitates war.
I mean, my understanding is that war is a collective.
Okay.
So there's a couple of reasons. So first of all, it's trying to attain national autarky. It's a confusion of the benefits of conquest exceeding those of cooperation. Whereas, you know, maybe a country, you know, I think economically we understand that on the whole a nation will benefit from trade by specializing in one area and trading with another. Now, when a country doesn't see this trade, though, as benefiting them as opposed to actually conquesting another country, they choose war. And so I'm trying to think. The best example would be maybe a country that's pillaging another country for oil, for example, because they realize that by them specializing in one commodity and trading for the oil, they will not get as much oil as if they overall just go in and take it for themselves. Now, what they don't realize is that there's channels of production, there's actually people that produce this oil, and there's a whole many number of factors that really are maximized or more efficient if you play the business game as opposed to the war game.
Yeah, I think one of the important things that people should understand is that economics does not recognize political borders. It's a political border is something that we construct artificially. But economic law, and Mises did believe there really are economic laws. Economic law does not change when a political border is crossed. And I just read a couple very interesting books. One was called The Wages of Destruction, The Making and Breaking of the Nazi Economy. And as you read this book, a chilling, chilling book, it was written by a gentleman by the name of Adam Tooze, T-O-O-Z-E, called The Wages of Destruction, The Making and Breaking of the Nazi Economy. And the Nazis, with Adolf Hitler as their sort of prime philosopher, unfortunately, believed that they could not be prosperous unless they actually sort of owned and controlled vast resources. And this just isn't really true. And the Japanese Shintoists and the Japanese military prior to World War II had a program they called the Greater Southeast Asia Co-Prosperity Plan. It was a fancy name to justify their conquest of much of Southeast Asia. They had the same idea. They saw that Japan was really did not have a lot of natural resources, and that Southeast Asia was rich in rubber and oil and other commodities, rice. And so they felt that, well, they would just have to conquer these countries so that they could ensure that the Japanese people did not starve and would be able to be, prosper. Well, I think we've seen, without getting too far into either of these books, I think we've seen since the end of World War II that both Germany and Japan have prospered far beyond what I think any of them ever believed possible, and they've done it through trade. There are we don't need political borders. Political borders are irrelevant. The Germans and the Japanese have been producing what they're really good at. This is called their comparative advantage, and they trade for things that other people are good at, which is growing grain in Eastern Europe and growing rice and oil in Southeast Asia for the Japanese. So,
yep.
Well, we're coming up to the end of this segment. It's gone very quickly, so we'll just ask, ladies and gentlemen, to please stay tuned. This is Pat Barron and Cole Chaney. It's Radio Free Market. When we come back from our break, we'll pick up on some other interesting topics about human action. So please stand by. Welcome back. This is Radio Free Market. I am your guest host, Pat Barron, along with my guest and a student at the University of Iowa, Cole Chaney. And before the break, we were talking about how Ludwig von Mises explained one of the great causes, unfortunately, one of the great causes of war in modern times, which is the desire for what's called autarky, which means that a nation feels that it has to politically control resources in order to benefit. And von Mises pretty well destroys that argument. And because economics knows no political borders, and you can trade for what you want, and people have achieved great prosperity and with peace, especially in Europe since World War II, Europe and Eastern Asia. So now we want to talk about the difference between capitalism and socialism, especially how does capitalism handle failures, and how does socialism handle failures, and what are the import of this? So, Cole, would you like to tackle that issue?
Yeah,
that
I'd love to touch on it. And sort of in lieu of bailout, I think a lot of people are always sort of wonder about relevant events, how they tie into sort of this age-old philosophy. You know, it seems like Mises was, you know, he's long gone, and so it's how does this apply today? But, you know, I think the big area that you see it shining is sort of how capitalism and socialism differ. And before we even get started, I'd like to make the point that, you know, Mises explains that it's not a choice between capitalism and socialism. It's a choice between capitalism and chaos, because socialism isn't a system per se. It's actually sort of just, it's anti-capitalism, and it leads to, you know, eventually squandered resources and in general, impoverished people. But that being said, you know, in terms of, you know, success and failure in the market, capitalism, it weeds out losers, so a government will not bail out a company that is maybe misallocating its capital or made the wrong entrepreneurial decision, whereas, you know, socialism rewards losers, either the person who plays the bureaucracy better or just the company as their first rather than the most efficient company. So then, you know, this problem compounds over years and years and years, so capitalism builds up capital, it gains prosperity, as it can pour these profits back into its business, whereas socialism slowly destroys capital, you know, and impoverishes its citizens and, you know, even the world as a whole.
That's very important. I think the best example that we've seen in our lifetimes, that Cole's a young man, but it doesn't seem that long ago to me, that the Soviet Union was considered to be a world power, and it was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. That's what USSR stood for, Socialist Republics. And they did. There were a lot of reasons that communism collapsed, but mainly it collapsed for economic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Communism, and which is just, I think you could just say is an extreme form of socialism. I'm not sure there is that much difference between the two. But socialism, communism, destroyed the great capital base of Russia and the republics that surrounded it, that made up the Soviet Union. People think that Russia was a backward country before the revolution, the communist revolution in 1917, but it was not entirely. It had many pockets of backwardness. The Russia in 1917 was very much the way Red China was maybe 20 years ago. There were pockets. It was a rising industrial power, but yet there was still a lot of poverty in the countryside. And Russia was a large country, but it was one of the most industrialized countries in the world. People don't realize that.
Well, you know, we're seeing now, I mean, China's having the same sort of issues, too. So that's what it's emerging. A lot of Chinese government and politics is sort of a farce. And we're seeing the same kind of collapse issues that we did see with Russia.
Yeah, well, there's some interesting stories out there about the ghost cities of China where they have been building cities. They're beautiful things with apartment buildings and malls and everything for the consumer, and there's no people there because there's no industry. So they put they sort of turned economics on its head. Instead of wealth and work generating prosperity and then people come in and they build apartment buildings for the workers. They decide, well, they're just going to build all this stuff, and if we build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
And there obviously, many economists feel that the Chinese so-called great expansion, economic expansion, in many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, is ephemeral and is not really true. They're just, when they build all these things, they count it to their gross national product. So the key point that Mises makes in Human Action, as you say, Cole, is that capitalism increases capital, and communism destroys capital. And the basis of all our prosperity, the basis of higher wages, the basis of just living a better life, is the employment of more capital in an economy. So we just plain produce more goods and services. So
yep.
Do you have anything else to add to that, Cole?
No, and I see our segment sort of coming to an end, too. So the only thing I can really say in closing on that is the fact that a capitalist society is directed by individuals, whereas a socialist society is directed by an institution or
very
a director.
Point.
And if you think about it, I mean, which is better, a single mind or a million people making up their decisions individually? So that's all I really say in closing.
Yeah, in fact, Mises' great student, most well-known student, Friedrich von Hayek, wrote about the pretense of knowledge, in which he said, well, it's really impossible for one dictator or even a group of dictators to understand everything that's going on in an economy. That just is not the way an economy works. An economy is billions and billions of individual decisions, but it's all coordinated by the price system. So perhaps when we come back from this break, we can talk a little bit more about that. But we are coming to the end of this segment of our show, so please stand by. This is Radio Free Market. It's Pat Barron and Cole Chaney, and we're talking about Ludwig von Mises and Human Action. So please stay with us. Well, welcome back. This is Radio Free Market. I am your guest host, Pat Barron, and my guest today is Cole Chaney, my student at the University of Iowa. And we are discussing the great book by Ludwig von Mises titled Human Action, a book that Cole studied in detail this summer. And Cole, before we took the last break, we've been talking about the way capitalism and socialism handle failure. But I wonder if now you could talk about a point that Mises makes about how socialism can really present itself in two forms.
Certainly. So there's really the German mode and the Russian mode. So, under no false pretense, Russia said that they are state-owned and operated. It's an authoritarian government. We are communist, socialist. And it was understood to the world, actually, and that's why there was such a fear of Russia. Now, the German model was a bit different. So they offered this this sort of facade of private ownership, where there actually were film companies that did independently make films. But that being said, they were government-run, they were government-directed. Government means of production were directed by German government. And so this is sort of, it's just because a country says or expresses itself as being, we are a capitalist-free society, we are a socialist society, might not be the case. I think the United States is sort of one of the examples, too, of a country that really touts its capitalistic merits, and yet we see a number of things, such as mortgage-backed insurance, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, that there are actually some socialist underpinnings.
Yeah, and make sure that our listeners understand that when we talk about the Russian and German models, in 1949, Mises was referring to, for the Russian model, he was talking about the Soviet Union. Russia today is probably has more of the hallmarks of the more of the Italian corporatist society, where the state does interfere quite a bit. And the German model that von Mises was talking about was the model of the Nazi Party and of Nazi Germany and the Nazi economy. And in that, as you say, Cole, the German Nazi Party, which represented the state, directed everything in the economy. The more I've read about how, and there are several very good books about how the Nazi economy was actually run, but down to many, many, even very minor details were directed by came directed by the top. What resources people were able to get for their businesses, what kind of products they could produce, how many, where they could be distributed, right down to who could be paid what price for their labor. So there was, as Mises says, there was the pretense of having a private ownership. So the Nazis, if a company failed because it couldn't produce a product and sell enough at a profit, then the Nazis took no responsibility for that. They said, well, you're a private company. But really, they were the ones that were responsible for the failure of that company.
Yeah.
And the books that I have read, there's a very good book out called Vampire Economy by a man by the name of Ryman. I forget his first name, but Vampire Economy. And and it was written and published actually before World War II. He was a German businessman, and he described how the Nazi economy worked, and he said the Nazi economy was actually regressing, that the German economy was regressing, the total economy was regressing. The Germans were pumping up the military side tremendously, so it was getting all the resources, and the rest of society was being denuded of real resources. The people were tremendously impoverished. And Ryman, if you deduce, you can read this between the lines, Ryman was saying that the Nazi economy at that point in time was on the verge of collapse when they started World War II.
And it is, I mean, I think you can direct a war effort that way, and it's certainly, I think it will produce results, because a war effort is not a market economy, but it's not something that's sustainable. So while it might get your short-term results of conquering Prussia or occupying Japan, this does not produce long-term sustainable capital growth, which is what you need to actually have a functioning country and economy.
Right, and even when another facet that I would just like to relate that I got a remember from the book by Tooze of The Wages of Destruction, and that was after Germany conquered France in 1940 and took over. Actually, the northern half of the country was actually run as an occupied territory by the Germans, and the southern half of the country was under the Vichy French, who were collaborating with the Nazis. But that French productivity plummeted, and it never recovered. In fact, the French, and you could say, and Tooze really never delves too much into, well, why did this happen, except to document that it did happen. But I think it happened because economies just cannot be run from the top. Slaves do not produce, are not as productive as free men. But actually, to the French credit, they added very little to the Nazi war economy. In fact, it probably could be said that they were actually a negative to the war economy. One example, because I have an Air Force background, was that Hitler And the Nazis were counting on French aircraft production to add to their German aircraft production.
Mm-hmm.
And it never materialized. The French aircraft production plummeted and never recovered. It produced very few aircraft that the Germans could actually use in the war.
Well, I think.
And, go ahead.
No, I mean on a large scale, and it's funny that, you know, you say even on a large scale. I mean, people make the argument for the Pilgrims who came over and they ran their sort of communist. People say the Pilgrims were communist. That's how they ran, but they were also starving up until the Indians bailed them out. I mean, that's what. On large scale and small scale, it's obviously unsustainable. I think Mises really hits that point home.
Yes. So we'll move on from that. And from there, Mises in Human Action does spend a lot of time refining something that he had actually made his mark on very early in his career. In 1913, he published The Theory of Money and Credit,
mm-hmm.
and it became really his first great book. And in Human Action, he devotes a lot of pages to money. And what is money? How does it arise? What is the purpose of money? And if there's anything at all, I think, in today's world that is misunderstood or not understood at all by the general public, it is the concept of money. So I wonder, Cole, you've got some ideas of what you would like, some things you'd like to read. To say about how Mises handles this. So I'll just sort of turn it over to you to talk about this as you wish.
Certainly. I mean, I think the first thing, too, in lieu of his absence, Michael McKay's really touched on the thought that it is sad in our modern-day society economy that one of the top reasons for divorce, stress, it comes down to money, and yet it's one of the least understood things also. So, you know, economics isn't taught in school. Generally, Keynesian economics is brushed on in like a college environment, but that being said, it can never hurt to learn more about it, sort of understand what is the basis, what is the root of money. And Mises sort of explains what I really like, and it took me a while to wrap my head around it, so correct me if I get too deep, and I might not even understand it totally, but it's the regression theory of money. It's the thought that the fact that I have a dollar today, where does it actually get its systemic value? You know, intrinsically, it is worth something. It's worth exchange value. But how do I know that? Well, I'd look to yesterday, and I'd say, well, the dollar was worth something yesterday, so I assume it'll be worth something tomorrow. But you can't do that forever. You know, there was a point when that dollar didn't exist. So how do you eventually get to that one point in time where that dollar turned from a piece of paper to an actual dollar, you know, something that's actually worth money? And that's actually because at one point, that dollar was exchanged for gold. And at one point, that gold was exchanged as purely gold, as a commodity. So the regression theory really explains that fiat money, you know, essentially introducing paper currency, telling the world, this is a dollar, that doesn't work. It actually, the whole point of money and the intrinsic value of money comes from a commodity being traded to the point that people realize that, you know, gold is valuable, its value in its own right as an industrial commodity, but also it can be traded in exchange for other commodities or other goods and services.
Yeah, this is very important because it means that governments cannot just create a money out of thin air with no background, that all fiat monies that we have today, and by fiat we mean that it is what it is, that the dollar, the yen, the euro, the British pound, the Chinese yuan, none of those are backed by anything. You can't say, well, I'm going to take my dollars to the Federal Reserve and they will give me gold for that. No, that it is what they'll do. If you take a $20 bill to the Federal Reserve, they'll say, well, would you like 4 fives or a 10 2/5s or how do you want that? And they'll just give you more pieces of paper. But Mises says monies always arise spontaneously. And, Cole, I think I showed an interesting little film clip, if you can recall.
I do.
Would you like to tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, so under certain environments, you know, there isn't money. It's not available. And I think one that comes immediately to mind, you know, besides maybe the moon or deep under the ocean, would be in prison. So there's actually, you know, there's no dollars being circulated amongst prisoners. And I think this was in a Nazi Germany camp. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was actually it's a movie called Stalag 17. It came out
Stalag
in the 1915s, And it was based upon actual prison life in a prisoner of war camp for American flyers who had been shot down over Germany.
Okay. So then with that basis, you know, what does Mises explain about currency? Well, it has to be, has to start as a commodity. It has to be easily divisible. It has to be tradable. You know, these are all things, it's very hard. For example, a car could theoretically be currency, but it's hard to trade a car for maybe some cereal or a sack of wheat. So it has to be something that you can really break down to a very small denomination. What's available in prison? Well, there's food, there's limited articles of clothing, and of course there's cigarettes. And so using these cigarettes as the currency, you realize that these prisoners basically set up their own underground economy based on that. They were using these cigarettes to gamble, to purchase things. And it really shows how a spontaneous commodity, you know, this being the tobacco leaf, turns into a currency on its own right.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to find this video either on Netflix or that's where I actually bought my copy, and you'll see that the cigarette is used as a trade item. Much as you're going to think of other things. When Lewis and Clark made their great expedition to the West Coast in the early part of the 19th century, actually it was during Thomas Jefferson's presidency, they took a lot of what they called trade goods. They took a lot of things they knew that the Native Americans would value, such as hatchets and knives and pots and things, but they also took beads. Mm-hmm. And beads were highly valued by the Native Americans. And those became sort of money in the West. And I think the myth is that, I think it really is probably a myth, that Manhattan was sold by the Native Americans to the Dutch for $26 worth of beads.
I think a big thing that Mises explains that we have to understand is Grisham's Law. You know, I think bad currency drives out good currency. And this is the thought that, you know, I think it's a little more difficult to understand with dollars, but I think in terms of gold, if you have two gold coins being traded in an economy, one of which is slightly diluted by silver, one is pure gold, which one are you more likely to hoard and which one will you trade? Well, you'll probably trade the one that's diluted with silver because it's obviously worth less, even though it's valuated higher. And so this, you know, this is a key point in explaining how a bad or diluted currency essentially gains circulation and, in fact, is not a good fiat money.
Well, in fact, I will, you know, here's what really, the Gresham's Law is that an overvalued currency will drive out an undervalued currency. And a currency can only be overvalued if government steps in and forces people to accept it. So in your example, Cole, of a gold dollar that is slightly diluted by silver, if in a free market people would recognize that and say, well, I will sell my sack of wheat for two real gold dollars or three gold dollars that have been diluted by silver. You know, there would be different exchange values. But when you have government, a government will say, no, you must accept these for all debts, public and private. Now, that's what's actually on the U.S. dollar bill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an overvalued currency. An overvalued by government decree will drive out an undervalued currency. But in a true free market, the opposite occurs. In this case, the better currency will drive out less worthy currency. So if you think of it as commodities, and getting back to our prison camp analogy, because I think this is so interesting, the men were using cigarettes. Well, how did they use cigarettes as currency? Well, they had other choices. As Cole said, they could have used food. Well, food was in short supply, but you know it would rot, and it had a higher value in the prison camp as actually its intrinsic value because the men were practically starving in the prison camp. You get to other things that they could use, and they get down to, well, the cigarette is the best available good that can be used for indirect exchange under the circumstances. In this case, the circumstances were the prisoner of war camp. Now, when the men were finally liberated from the prison camp, then they went back into normal society, and the cigarette was not, in the West, was not used as a trade good. But here's what's very important. Everyone who grew up after World War II and traveled to Eastern Europe, as I did, when I was in the military, I traveled to Russia, the Soviet Union, the cigarette was still used as a trade good because the currencies were so bad in those countries. When I went to the Soviet Union, when I was in the military, we were encouraged to take our allotted 2 cartons of cigarettes because we could actually give these to people to thank them for things that they did for us, you know.
Cool.
And they would value these more highly than anything else. And it was very, very rare for anyone to actually break open the cellophane of a pack of cigarettes. If anyone actually did this, it would be the equivalent of you or I, Cole, you know, rolling up a $100 bill and lighting a cigar with it or something. We're just not going to do it.
Full circle smoking analogy, Pat.
Yeah, we're getting all around to smoking. Well, this is very interesting, and you know, Mises goes into great detail about money, how it comes into existence, how it is used, and, of course, what, as Mises says, money is a product of the market and should be is just as much a product of the market as anything else and should be treated as such, and government should not interfere with it. It should be left completely to the free market. Well, we're coming up to the end of this this segment, which is our longest segment. We have one more short segment left, and when we come back, Cole and I are going to talk about why anyone should study economics. So this is Pat Barron along with Cole Cheney at Radio Free Market. So please stand by. Welcome back. This is Pat Barron along with Cole Cheney. It's Radio Free Market. And Cole today and I are discussing Ludwig von Mises' great book, his magnum opus, as they call it, Human Action. And Cole, in Human Action, among the many, many subjects that Mises talks about, toward the end of his book, he has a segment about why economics is important. By reading this, does he think that everyone should study economics, or is it only for sort of just eggheads and people that don't have anything better to do on a Saturday?
Egwin, long-winded blowhards like you and I?
Yeah.
No, of course not. So there's a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, I think what people don't realize is that economics is not finance. So finance is a study of money, interest rates. Economics, certainly that ties into it, but economics is tracking human action through dollar bills. It's seeing how people make the decisions they do and allocate their time and resources. So the reason why you'd study it, I mean, it's inherent in the name human action. It's the study of what man does. And because of that, you can really become a freer person, or at least a more understanding person of the world around you. The world won't hit you in the face. Now you'll understand what is happening. Otherwise, you know, I mean, the government, I don't want to say they're conniving, but there are a lot of liberties that do come and go. So because of that, if you can understand the fundamental basis of your freedoms and your actions through economics, you can really understand then if a government, a business, another person is infringing on that, and you can use that to act appropriately.
Well, and I think one of the things that I have found through, and I really admire young people like yourself, Cole, who have come to Austrian economics and learned about it at an early age. I learned about it at a very late age, and I can't even really remember how it happened. But I sort of started reading one book, and that led to another, and I realized at that point that this is real economics, and this is reality.
Yep. Yep.
And that what you come to realize is that many things that you see in the world that you don't think that you might not believe at first can be explained by economics, but they can be explained by economics. And I find myself marveling at this all the time, especially when I travel overseas. You'll be things that'll sort of I'll see things and I'll wonder why that is, and you'll see that well there's an economic explanation for this. I just remember Cole in our class there was a young lady who had been to India, and when she came back I had just asked her, you know, did you see anything there that was of interest to you or you would like to talk about, and she talked about how the in India, she really didn't see much use of machinery. Where in America you would see a backhoe or something that was digging foundations for a building, in India it would be a whole army of men with picks and shovels. And why was this? And we discussed that. I mean, essentially it means there's a lack of capital in the economy.
Yep.
And so what is the meaning for that? The other thing I think is very important that I'm very concerned about is if you don't understand economics and you allow the government to supplant your ability to act freely, you eventually are giving up your real liberty. And this is important, is you cannot be free politically if you are not free economically. And the best example of this is what goes on in Cuba. In Cuba, because the state controls every job, if you get on the Cuban blacklist, and they don't throw you in jail, but you're just on their blacklist, you cannot work in the Cuban economy, such as it is. Now you're just you're practically a beggar. And this has been documented. This is what happens. This is one way you can punish people in a completely controlled economy. You just do not allow them to work for a living.
Yep.
And so it's very dangerous. Well, we are coming to the end of a very, very wonderful show. Cole, thank you very much for participating in this with me.
Thank you, Professor.
And this is Pat Barron with Cole Chaney, and this has been Radio Free Market. Please tune in next week. And for another very interesting discussion. And you can subscribe to us for free, Radio Free Market, and you can get or through iTunes. So please stand up for freedom.